dropped. I remember borrowing one of those once from my company and using it to listen to the local oscillator on a ICOM IC2AT handy talkie. And the way that IC2AT works is that the local oscillator operates at half the RF frequency, roughly 72 megs. And once I found that out, I went listening to the local oscillator out of a IC2AT handy talkie at 70 megacycles, and using nothing on the receiver as a piece of wire that was 6 inches long on a synthesized receiver, where the IF strip went into that dynamic signal analyzer tuned to the 70 megahertz local oscillator, and I was able to hear the local oscillator coming out of that handy talkie, a well-shielded unit inside of a metal case, if you study what's actually inside that whole package, and I could see that from half a mile away using an extremely yucky antenna, which was just a 6-inch piece of wire stuck into a BNC connector on the front end of a receiver. It wasn't even using a well-tuned antenna. It wasn't even a Yagi that was aimed in the right direction. At half a mile away, I could find that local oscillator. When you got the right kind of filtering characteristic on something like a PAN adapter, which has that kind of digital signal processing, does that allow you to find signals? Wow. Okay. I think this week we're going to get a launch of a space shuttle, and I think that that very fancy gamma ray telescope is about to go up and be installed on the International Space Station. Isn't that true? And is going to be any delay on that one, Paul? WS2N, our space expert. Make sure you wait every minute and a half with an interruption. K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N, but space portion of the net, I guess. Yeah, well, that's delayed to the end of the month, the 29th of April for STS-134-6. We'll have to wait a little bit longer. I know it was supposed to go up this week, but there's always something that creeps in there. And right now, it's not a technical problem. It's a progress ship that's going to be involved with the International Space Station at that time. So it's a time conflict. So that's why it's been pushed back a little bit. And then you'll have the final flight of the space shuttle 2 months after that. So this is the one where Mark Kelly's going up, the husband of the congresswoman that was shot. So this was originally supposed to be the final flight. He's the commander, but then more than a couple of months ago, they decided to add one more flight to the whole thing, and that would be Atlantis. Let me drop it. So I thought I'd mention that this will be the 30th year anniversary of the space shuttle system. It started the 12th of April of this month. So what is it? A little over 130 flights. Two of them very unsuccessful. The space shuttle has killed off 14 people. Two orbiters were destroyed in the 30-year period. Two out of 134 flights is not good, but it has been quite successful. They've done a lot. They put a space station up there, put a Hubble space telescope up. It's really succeeded in what it's planned on doing. Launched rockets to Jupiter. It launched the Galileo space probe to Jupiter, and put space probes to Venus. The Magellan spacecraft that orbited Venus with a radar detecting mission for a couple of years. It's done quite a bit. surface satellites, Madravis. And it's been 30 years. And ironically, when that went up, it was the 20th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's mission, the first man in space. So here we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of that. We've come a long way since then. You know, they used to fly one guy up all by themselves in Russia, and we eventually did that with Mercury. Except, I mean, they were really primitive. They went up there, they make like one orbit, come back, and they, you know, everybody thinks, well, okay, they parachuted down. All right, they landed on land, but he landed on land, but he. But he literally parachuted down. I mean, they'd come down 4 miles up, he'd hit a button, eject himself with an ejection seat out of the spacecraft, and float down to around 2 miles up, actually around 13,000 feet, and then he would separate from the ejection seat and come flying down in a rest of the way on a parachute, and that's how they used to land. So we've come a long way from that. I mean, even the first woman that did that, Valentina Tereshkova, she, same thing. They picked her. She was good at parachuting. So they put her on board there, and now here we are, all these years later, landing with vehicles that look like airplanes and we drop it. Not that the Russians didn't try. They built a craft that looked exactly like the space shuttle. It did fly in space with no people. They never put anybody on board. But it did fly in space and came down and landed, called Braun. So we're the only ones with this space shuttle, and now it's going to be retired. Any future flights you'll see, they'll be coming down in parachutes. And instead of, well, what we're going to do is have them land on land and not on water, like the Apollo missions. But we're going back to almost a 1960 design, 1970 design with spacecraft landing with parachutes. That's kind of unbelievable, but that's what we're going to do. And now they're fighting over where they're going to put the space shuttles. The final one for Discovery, that's already earmarked for the Smithsonian in Washington. Let me drop it. And everybody else is putting up tens of millions of dollars to get their bid in to try to get the remaining last shuttles. Well, actually, the Smithsonian used to have the Enterprise, which was the space shuttle that went up that was never went into outer space. They would drop it from a 747, and they tested the landing capabilities of it. I mean, it was a regular space shuttle. I mean, it did fly with people in it, and that is now going to be moved to somewhere else. We don't know yet, and then Discovery is going to take that place at Smithsonian. Where that's going to wind up, and where Endeavour is going to wind up, and Atlantis, we don't know. So I'd like to see it wind up in New York, down in a Intrepid Museum or something. But we'll find out. There's, I think, 20 some odd places looking to house the remnants of the shuttles. And that's the Space Report, Dick, WS2F.
Have they said much, Paul, about this, what is it called now, large magnetic detector? I can't think of the name of the darn thing, which is going to be measuring these super strong cosmic rays, and that detector, it's a very heavy, great big magnet that's part of that that's going to go up on the shuttle, and it's going to be installed on the International Space Station and stay operational for a couple of years. Have they made any further words of encouragement about that part of the project, Paul, with what you've been reading? Go ahead.
That's still going to be installed on a truss. I think the I don't know if it's the port or the starboard truss, I don't remember, but it's probably about 100 feet away from the Z1 truss. Z1 is the center truss that's attached to, that's one of the first truss pieces that were put up there. So that's probably the center. It looks like about 100 feet away from what I saw. And, yeah, I forgot what that was called, too. But, they call that an alpha thing. Alpha, or like an alpha magnetic. It's supposed to do the something to do with a magnetic field. Alpha magnetic spectrometer, I think it was. It's a big unit. It's coming out of the back of the space shuttle cargo bay, and they'll install with their robotic arm and two EVAs to do it. By the way, that robotic arm's not coming back. It's going to stay attached to the space station for future use by the space station. Back to you, Dick.
Yep, that's not coming down. And by the same token, there are people who thought that someday we would bring the Hubble Space Telescope down for repair and bring it back. No way in hell. It's an extremely heavy piece of hardware. You go there and repair it on site. You don't bring it down. To bring something down that's extremely heavy on the space shuttle, it sounds like a nice, simple thing to do. And if you think about conservation of energy, you suddenly realize that there's a tremendous amount of kinetic energy that was put into the velocity of that heavy object, whether it be the alpha magnetic detector or whether it be the Hubble Space Telescope. A tremendous amount of kinetic energy was required to take this heavy object and accelerate it to 17,500 miles an hour. You take that thing back into the cargo hold of the space shuttle and try to bring it back home. You must dissipate all of that kinetic energy. And what dissipates that energy? The leading edge of the wing, the carbon-carbon reinforced high-temperature tiles. So those tiles are going to run a lot hotter, and you know what happened on one of the on Columbia when one of those tiles failed. So all that extra heat has to be dissipated on the way back home. So you don't bring home heavy objects, with rare exception. You don't do that anymore. It's too dangerous. Okay, let me drop this. Another interesting thing that happened this week. On National Public Radio this week, they featured a person named Mark Kaufman, who has just published a book entitled First Contact. It's a Simon & Schuster book. Mark Kaufman is the national editor and science writer for the Washington Post, a respected author. And he's written a book called First Contact, subtitled Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. It's a 210-page book. I bought a copy of it. It was published April of 2011, so the book is a week old. I've only read the first chapter. Looks to me like it's extremely well done. The book costs something like $16.95 from Amazon or something like that, plus postage. Looks like a goodie. And so the last time I recommended a book was the book by Mary Roach called Packing for Mars, which I think was a 2010 book. I'm looking at it right now. Very well done. Yeah, 2010 was the copyright on Packing for Mars. Tells you a lot about what goes on in the space program. In the case of this new book, First Contact, it tells you what they know about the 500 exoplanets they found so far. And Mark Kaufman, the author, goes through a nice display. Let me drop. I said display. A nice rundown of what we know about the possibility of extremophiles and life in other places. We used to think that life was an extremely delicate thing that required just the right conditions that we've got on Earth. Well, you can find living organisms that are inside of the hot magma coming out of a volcano. You can find them in the hot holes of water coming out of deep portions of the ocean. You can find them in the ice water that's underneath the ice of the Antarctic. You can find life in all kinds of crazy places, in acid baths and so on. places where you're positive nothing would live. Well, there are living organisms on this planet living in those places. And as such, that gives you a little bit more of a feeling for where are we going to find life in the other planets around this sun or around other planets around other suns. Since there are 10 to the 22 solar systems, since there are 10 to the 22 suns that are in the observable universe. And one of the TED displays, I can't think of who it was now, one of the smart guys, I was watching one of those lectures, let me drop, where he said, what is 10 to the 22? I mean, that's how many stars there are in the observable universe. 10 with 22, 1 with 22 zeros after it. That's approximately equal to the number of grains of sand that are on all of the beaches on planet Earth. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is you could take a sheet of paper and say that there are 1 billion molecules on that sheet of paper. And now I'm going to pile up sheets of paper until I have 10 to the 22 molecules. How high would that pile of sheet of paper be? 1 billion molecules per sheet of paper, and I want 10 to the 22 molecules total. And those sheet of papers would pile up to be something like two-thirds of the distance between here and the moon. So 10 to the 22 is a big number, and it's hard to experience that, hard to feel what it really is. And there's good evidence now that a high percentage of all the stars out there have got solar systems. So even if the right conditions like we've got on Earth, the so-called Goldilocks zone, is 1 in a million, that takes 10 to the 22 and cuts it down to 10 to the 16, if you know what I mean. That's still a huge number. There's a lot of life out there. You have to conclude that. And so talking to it, that first big QSO in the sky, it's going to take a while, but lots of smart people are predicting it's going to take place in this century and maybe in the next one or two decades. We're moving very fast in that direction. It used to be an extremely unacceptable project. In other words, if you 20 years ago, if you wrote a proposal that you wanted to do a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, they would say, you're a crazy person, you're a mystic, you're a dreamer. Nowadays, it's acceptable. We're suddenly discovering that life is so universal and that the conditions for it are nowhere near as stringent as we used to think.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And the number of solar systems that are out there is so large that it's time to start talking about not whether or not we are alone, not whether or not there are anybody else out there. The only thing to discuss now is how many and how far and how easy is it to contact them and how easy is it to find evidence. You listen to the TED display, a TED conference by Jill Tarter, who is the president of the SETI Institute in California. Very interesting presentation that she made on TED. You just Google those words, TED and Jill Tarter, and listen to that 18-minute speech, and you're going to say, wow, that's good stuff. Okay, what should I tell you about that? Now, Wesley had a series of questions that he asked me, and question number one was, when you've got a standing wave ratio taking place inside of a coax cable, does any of that signal leak out? Let me drop. That's an extremely good question, because the world is filled up with people on the 20-meter band. I like to attack the people on the 20-meter band. The world is filled up with people on the 20-meter band who will say that you must lower the standing wave ratio on your antenna as a way of lowering the television interference, that your coaxial cable will now start radiating a signal because there was a standing wave ratio. Good sounding common sense. 95% of the time it's dead wrong. What goes on inside of a piece of coax cable, what happens on that semiconductor, is extremely well shielded by that outer conductor. As long as you've got a well-installed connector, the right kind of a balancing device and whatever, a good shielded cabinet on your transmitter, you could have a whopping big signal on the semiconductor of that coax cable, and essentially none of it gets to the outside world. Now, if you're an electromagnetic interference expert, and you're using very, very sensitive instrumentation, yes, you will find a signal that leaks from the inside of the coax cable to the outside. But that signal is approximately 100 decibels weaker. That's a 10 billion to 1 ratio. A little bit of that signal leaks out in between the braid. And if you're willing to use hardline, that number becomes a much bigger number as to the amount of isolation. So nothing leaks out. Now, Wesley's next question is, if I start drilling holes in the outside of the coax cable, in the vicinity where you've got the hot spots, the high current, because of a standing wave inside, will the signal leak out? And the answer is yes. Let me drop. And you don't even have to be careful as to where you drill the holes. For the last 30 or 40 years, there is a standard product in the Andrew catalog. Andrew, by the way, is the company in Illinois that arguably is the largest producer of coaxial cable and the largest producer of radio amplifiers on planet Earth, Andrew. And they make a product called Radiax. It's a kind of coaxial cable that looks like Andrew Heliax coaxial cable, a high-quality kind of ridged, rippled, hardline cable. Andrew Heliax is a very popular kind of commercial-grade or military-grade hardline coaxial cable used on the majority of radio towers in commercial service. But they make a version of Andrew Heliax called Radiax, which has periodic holes drilled in the outer conductor. And why in the world would you want to do that? And the answer is, it gives you a very controlled amount of leakage of the signal from the inside of the cable to the outside of the cable. And why would you want to do that? Let me drop. If you investigate what's inside of many of the subway systems, particularly the one in New York City and Toronto, down all of those subway tunnels is Andrew Heliax. And they put numbers like 40-watt radio signals into the leading edge of that Andrew Radiax cable, and the signal slowly leaks out during the length of the cable, and you go about 5 subway stations downrange, and the signal is still there leaking out. So you've got your handy-talkie in your hand, and you're either on the subway car or you're walking down the tracks if you have permission to do that, and that's another whole situation. You have to go to track school before you can legally walk down those tracks of a subway. It's a very dangerous condition. But you walk down those tracks of the subway system with your handy-talkie in your hand, and you can transmit and receive, ordinarily in that subway tunnel, that signal goes about a fraction of a mile and dies. But because of the Radiax cable that's taped, that's screwed down to the walls of the subway tunnel, the signal can slowly leak into the cable or leak back out of the cable, whether you're talking about the transmit frequency or the receive frequency, and now you've got some beautiful communication in a place where it normally would not take place. The signal does slowly leak out. It does slowly get weaker. And about 5 subway stations downrange, there's an amplifier to build up the signal to go the next 5 stations. It's a bidirectional amplifier, by the way. There's an amplifier going from east to west, and another amplifier for the east to west for the receive frequency, so to speak, and west to east for the transmit frequency. So you got bidirectional amplifiers every 5 stations or so. The exact number I don't know, but it doesn't matter. That's something that's look-upable and calculatable, but you see the principle of operation. So controlled leakage from a coax cable is a beautiful way of leaking a small amount of intentional signal out of a coaxial cable.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But ordinarily, coaxial cable, where the outer conductor is in normal integrity, is an extremely well-shielded structure. And if you take a coaxial cable and wind it into a coil, the signal that's on the inside of the coaxial cable on the center conductor and the signal that's on the outside of the coaxial cable on the outside of the shield are 2 thoroughly independent signals. And if you're smart enough, you can treat them independently, or by what you do on the end, you can carefully couple one to the other and make fancy tuning circuits. So coaxial cable and learning how that particular kind of transmission line works when you want it to be shielded and works when you don't want it to be shielded, very interesting structures. There's a lot to be learned there. The other question the first three questions that, that Wesley asked is, when you take some of these transmitting coils that are sold on the internet, I've seen a picture of one of those being sold on eBay, that Wesley pointed out to us, or you look at some of the transmitters that are multi-band transmitters, you'll find that the coil is wound on a ceramic form. This is an airspace coil on a ceramic form. And at one end, the coil line, the windings are close together, and the other end, they're far apart. And Wesley's asked, why do they do that? Let me drop. The answer is you get the best of both worlds when you do that. In the case of a Pi filter network, where you've got an input tuning capacitor shunted to ground, a series inductor, which is part of the Pi network, and then another shunt capacitor at the far end to ground. In almost all cases, you've got a high impedance at one end, that's usually where the tube is, and the low impedance on the other end, that's where the 50 ohm output coaxial cable is, the connector coming out of your transmitter, or you're out of your matchbox, your antenna tuner. So one end of the coil is virtually grounded, and one end of the coil is very far away from ground. It's got a great big RF voltage on it. If you take the end of the coil that's close to ground, and you space the turns close together, you get a lot of inductance in a small package and convenient tuning. The place where the voltage is very high, the other end of the coil, the stray capacitance at that end is very sensitive. The high voltage means that a small amount of capacitance is going to create a whole lot of current flowing through that small amount of capacitive reactance. So you want the capacitive reactance between the coil turns of the coil to be small at the high voltage end. You do that by spacing the coil windings farther on the high voltage end. So by having variations of the spacing, you get the best of both worlds. You get the most contact, you get the most compact coil, the most amount of high Q inductance in a small package, and yet the stray capacitance between the turn, the windings, don't hurt you as much when you taper the windings. One of the things that's never been properly investigated from my point of view, let me drop, is in the case of a helix antenna. A helix antenna and a Yagi antenna have a strong amount of common theory of operation. When you build a high-performance Yagi antenna, the individual parasitic elements are not all the same length. They generally taper to a smaller length as you go further forward on the Yagi, but not necessarily. Some of the really good designs have a so-called Coke bottle shape to them, where the elements are smaller in the middle, and they start getting a little bit larger out toward the forward tip. But so, various lengths of elements and various spacings of parasitic elements on a high-performance Yagi does give you greater performance. Therefore, if you're building a helical antenna equivalent, a circular polarized Yagi-like structure, and you're building it as a helical antenna, you should be varying the spacing and the diameter of the individual turns of the helix in order to get maximum performance. I've never seen an article that does that. I've seen some articles where they taper the helical turns a little bit smaller toward the forward end. And there's a log periodic version that does that. But when it comes to the jumping up and down of diameter and spacing in order to get the highest possible performance out of a helical antenna, I've never seen that. It's time somebody go out and do it. The modeling programs can handle it. And to do it as a backyard project on a antenna range could give you a lot of bang for the dollar. So those are some of the quick answers to the first three of the seven questions that you've mailed me today, Wesley.
One of them was that the Gauss meter. Question number two.
Yeah, if you put a Gauss meter near the holes that you've made in a coaxial cable, a hardline piece of coax cable, is equivalent to putting a receiver with a sniffer wire near the holes of Andrew Radiacs. Does signal leak out of there? Absolutely. Does signal leak out of there at the radio frequency? Absolutely. usually you do not use a Gauss meter to measure radio frequency magnetic fields. You could, but they don't. Gauss meters are almost always used for measuring a steady state magnetic field, something you get out of a neodymium magnet or out of an electromagnet with a steady state current.
How about if you don't drill the holes?
If you don't drill the holes, there is no signal coming out of that coax cable.
Here's the point. If you have a magnetic field, the magnetic field is not immune to the shielding. It's a magnetic field, part of the electromagnetic field. Would you be able to feel with the probe of the Gauss meter presence of the magnetic part of that, that field in the hot spot? When you put your hand on it, you feel that it's hotter.
Yeah, you've asked a complicated question, and the answer has both a yes and a no answer. Let's go slowly on this one. If I have a steady state magnetic field coming from a neodymium magnet or an electromagnet, a steady state magnetic field, and I try to shield that magnetic field with a great big thick sheet of copper, nothing will happen. In other words, I put my Gauss meter 1 foot away from your great big magnet. I measure a certain amount of magnetic field. I rapidly slip a piece of copper sheet in between your Gauss meter and my magnet. For a few milliseconds, you will see no magnetic field. And then a few milliseconds later, you will see a magnetic field. The depth of penetration of a magnetic field into a sheet of copper, the so-called skin depth, is a function of frequency. A steady-state magnetic frequency, steady-state magnetic field, has a frequency of zero. The skin depth is infinity. It'll go through the magnetic sheet. So, as long as the magnetic field is changing slow enough, the sheet of copper is a perfect shield. If I try to shield a 60-cycle magnetic field leaking out of a poorly designed 60-cycle transformer, it would take a very thick sheet of copper, six-sided box with very well soldered all six sides in order to shield that magnetic field. New metal would do a better choice. But to do it with pure conductive shielding, if the frequency is high enough and the copper is thick enough, no magnetic field gets through it. It's a skin depth situation. Usually your coax cable with a standing wave ratio is running at a radio frequency. At a radio frequency, the outer magnetic, the outer copper covering of a piece of
repeater, timeout, cancel.
At a radio frequency, the outer copper covering of a piece of Andrew Heliax, for instance, has a skin depth of 1/1000th of an inch, and the copper is 5/1000th of an inch thick. So almost no magnetic field at a radio frequency will get out of that coax cable. But now if I put a steady state current on the center conductor, a steady state current really is zero frequency, then yes, every bit of that magnetic field from the steady state current on the center conductor will be present on the outside of that coaxial cable as if there was no outer conducting there at all. So it's a very frequency-sensitive phenomena you're discussing. And now, if I start putting holes in the coaxial cable outer conductor, like Andrew Radiax, now I can go to higher and higher frequencies and still get that magnetic field out of that coaxial cable. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Now, if you, instead of putting the electromagnetic sine wave into the center conductor, you put a square wave into the center conductor, then you have that radiac with the holes. Because the square wave contains a certain number of the sine wave in order to construct the square wave, which you then have a control over which part of the sine waves out of the square wave will leak out.
Yeah, I can take a piece of Andrew Radiax intentionally leaky coaxial cable. And I can test it at a whole series of frequencies. 1 megacycle, 3 megacycles, 10 megacycles, 50 megacycles, 100 megacycles, 500 megacycles, 5,000 megacycles. I'll get a slightly different amount of leakage at each individual frequency. And I think it leaks a little bit faster as you go up in frequency, as I believe it does. As you go up in frequency, the signal leaks away a little bit faster. So if I did individual tests on individual frequencies, I could find out exactly how much leakage I get out of that piece of radiax. Now, if I put all of those frequencies there simultaneously, with just the right amplitude and just the right phase, I can construct for you a square wave, a triangle wave, a sawtooth wave, a parabolic wave. I can make all kinds of waves. By way of a Fourier series, you tell me the characteristics of your square wave, even if it's got slants to the individual tops and bottoms of your square wave. You tell me the characteristics of your square wave, and then I let you do a Fourier series analysis by which you tell me how much 1 megacycle energy, how much 3 megacycle energy, how much 5 megacycle energy is there. And I previously did an experiment where I put in just 1 megacycle and I measured the leakage, and just 3 megacycles and I measured the leakage, and just 5 megacycles and I measured the leakage. By the law of superposition, I'll get that answer. I take that complicated waveform, like your square wave, I know exactly how much 1 meg, 3 meg, and 5 megs is present. I previously found out how much 1 meg, 3 megs, and 5 megs leaks out of the cable when it's done one frequency at a time. And that...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And now that I'm doing it with all those frequencies present simultaneously, and I know how strong each one of those frequencies was present on the square wave to begin with, and I know how much the cable leaks on each one of those frequencies, I can therefore predict exactly how strong will each of those frequencies be on the outside of the cable. And it's not going to be a square wave anymore. It's going to be a spiky wave, because the high frequency notes are going to be emphasized. The high frequency notes will come out of the leaky coax cable faster than the low frequency nodes. Therefore, your square wave is going to become more spiky as opposed to rounded off, if you know what I mean.
How about if you make progressively holes and then you put the square wave, would you be then able to construct sort of directional coupler in which, because of the components of the square wave, will leak a 1 megahertz frequency through the number of holes, 2 megahertz to a certain other number of holes and whatsoever. Back to you.
What you're doing is you're reinventing a beautiful wheel. If you look up a kind of waveguide directional coupler, which is called a Bethe coupler, B-E-T-H-E, Bethe hole directional coupler in waveguide, they're doing exactly what you're describing. You've got two pieces of waveguide slide by side at a slight angle to each other, not exactly parallel, and you drill some carefully constructed holes between the two pieces of waveguide. You will construct a Bethe hole directional coupler, where across a particular frequency region, it will have a certain coupling coefficient and a certain amount of directivity. That's what you're describing. And the Bethe hole directional coupler did that all roughly 1945. And 2XJN, you're re-deriving a beautiful wheel, T2RAW. Go ahead, Meg Wesley.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Let's move further to question number 4.
Okay, I'm reading question number 4 and see if I can understand it. Will coaxial structure strip ability of inner wire and interact with any other coil in the vicinity of coaxial cable, making inner wire being dedicated only to shield? I'm going to skip ahead here, and what I think you're saying is if I lay two pieces of coaxial cable side by side, the center conductor of coaxial cable number 1 and the center conductor of coaxial cable number 2 are thoroughly shielded from each other because neither of those signals gets to the outside world of those individual coax cables.
system was different. What I was trying to do is, you have a correctional structure, which would be the strip. It would be the certain length of the coaxial cable. Now, what I'm trying to find out is I'm trying to find out the behavior of the coils as the straight length of the wire is the coil by itself. Now, what I'm trying to find out, how would behave two pieces of wire with heat light in parallel of the length of six feet, let me jump, one next to the other, and then you have the same structure, but you have a coaxially placed structure, which would be exactly 6 foot length of the coaxial cable, where the center conductor is surrounded by the shield. Now, if I put the signal into that the inner wire, and then what I'm trying to say is, would then surrounding shield somehow strip that inner wire with ability to couple inductively to any other structure next to it? In other words, it's like that. I have two wires lining on the table with heat exactly the distance like it is between the central conductor and the shield to make it parallel. Now, if I put the voltage into the first one, the voltage will be inducted if it's AC in the second one. But if I put many of them, each one will get a part of the induction from the first one. My understanding is that if I use, instead of these two, I use this the coaxial cable, I put the alternated voltage into the central conductor, and then I have a surrounding shield. Now, would that surrounding shield prevent the inner conductor to interact inductively with any other, let's say, wire that is lying next to the coaxial cable? What I'm trying to find is behavior of two coils in configuration of circular concentric and the configuration of parallel. Back to you.
Yeah, I think I see where you're going here. Let's assume that I took a piece of 14-gauge wire and wound it into an air coil with a certain spacing and a certain diameter between the turns, and I know how much inductance I've got. And I wind a second coil like that, and I put the two coils side by side, or put one inside of the other, or put them at right angles to each other. In all three of those cases, I have a certain amount of cross-coupling between those coils. In each one of those cases, except for the one where the axis of the two coils are at right angles, now the amount of coupling between the two becomes very small. If I take either one of those coils and wrap the wire of that coil with an outer sheath of coaxial cable, the wire no longer has any inductance. All of the inductance of that wire, due to its length and turns and diameter and spacing, all of that original inductance disappears. All of the radiation from coil number one to coil number two disappears, as long as I properly treat that outer shield of the first coil. It has no radiation to the outside world of any kind at radio frequencies. Yes, if I put a steady state current through that center conductor of the coaxial cable, yes, there is a steady state magnetic field that eventually leaks out of that outer shield of the coax. But if either of the coils has a coaxial sheath around it, no radiation of any kind at radio frequencies per se takes place. Now, to a electromagnetic interference expert with very sensitive instruments, he will measure a leakage signal 100 dB negative, 100 dB down, but which is such an infinitesimal signal, assume it's zero. So if I...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So once again, if I put a coaxial cable around any one of those wires, It shields it from the route from the rest of the universe if I treat the coaxial cable shield correctly. Now, if I treat it incorrectly, if I do something funny at the end of the cable, I could make the signal that goes down the center conductor of the coaxial cable. When it reaches the end, I can then, by various techniques, force the signal to then jump onto the outside of the coaxial cable, and now I get a very different set of results. But depending on how I treat that shield in the ideal world makes everything on that center conductor disappear as far as the outside world is concerned. But now if I make some measurements about what's going on the center conductor to shield of that first coil, it really is a coaxial cable that has a certain length, it has a certain kind of termination at the far end, that will give it a certain amount of reflection coefficient, impedance versus frequency that I can measure at the input end, and the fact that the whole coaxial cable is wrapped as a coil does not matter as long as I treat the shield properly. That shield, used properly, stops all signal from the center conductor from getting to the rest of the universe. Isn't that crazy? N2XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJM, I spoke to Glenn and I spoke to Eric in this area. The interesting fact is that, let's say, center conductor has a delivered a signal of 2 kilohertz frequency. Now, the inner one, the shield is not grounded. Now, the shield will be responding with capacitive component and inductive component into that signal. So, the shield will become a second coil of the transformer. Now, I put another coat of the shield, which will be insulated like the coaxial cable, and then I would measure what's going on with the third shield, which would be the third coil of the transformer. Three of them are insulated. The first one, which is the inner one, has the 2 kilohertz, let's say, or 3 kilohertz frequency delivered. The second one is not grounded, and the third one is not grounded. How would that structure behave? Would then the center conductor be able to interact with both of them, or the center conductor will be only able to interact inductively with the first shield, which will not be the shield any longer, and then that shield will react with the third one. Back to you.
Yeah, what you're describing is called triaxial cable. In other words, a center conductor with a insulator and then an outer shield, another layer of insulator and another outer shield. So it's a triaxial cable, and you have decided not to ground either one of the two outer shields. When I take a coax cable and don't ground the outer shield, and I put a signal on the center conductor, that's a very different case. Now, how much signal appears on the first shield is not only a function of what is the impedance of the cable, and what is the length of the cable, and how tightly wound is the cable. In other words, how many turns per inch and what diameter makes a difference. The first shield is itself a coil. It has a certain number of turns per inch, a certain diameter, a certain overall length, certain kind of resonance characteristics all by itself, and you didn't ground either end. So it is a resonant coil floating in space that has some stray capacitance to the center conductor by way of the dielectric material. Let me drop. So that now as you put that 2 kilohertz signal in your example on the center conductor, without a doubt you're going to get some significant amount of signal on the first outer conductor. That first outer conductor has a signal on it which in turn will conduct itself to the second outer conductor at a different signal level. So both of those inner and outer shields are going to have some 2 kilohertz signal on them. They're going to have a kind of a standing wave on them because they've got a certain length and the ends are unterminated. They're open-circuited on each end. They've got a certain length, a certain amount of inductance, and the length also gives them a certain wavelength characteristic. A fairly complicated circuit, but good computer modeling will tell you what you can get, or with the instrumentation you already own, you can measure that situation. So if I don't ground the shields, they will pick up signals, and the signals will couple in between them in a somewhat predictable manner. Complicated circuit, and there are cases where that can give you an advantage. If you study all of the bounding structures that have ever been made out of triaxial and biaxial twisted pair wires and coaxial cables, let me drop. When you study all of those Grunella balans and all of these other balaning structures that were done by W2FMI, I keep forgetting his name. Mel, what is W2FMI's name?
Lee Civic.
Got it. Lee Civic. Civic was his first, his last name. What's his first name?
Jerry.
That's right. Jerry Civic. All right. So Dr. Jerry Civic of Bell Laboratories, who's now a silent key, wrote a whole bunch of articles on various ways of taking a twisted pair and 3 wires twisted and 4 wires twisted, which is a kind of coaxial cable, by the way, and winding them on pieces of ferrite and interconnecting them various ways. He was doing the things that you're slowly starting to do, Wesley. And I didn't say it's easy. You study those balancing structures and the various ways you interconnect those inner and outer shields, or the first, second, and third winding of a triaxial, of a 3-wire twisted pair or 3-wire twisted wires, and you wind that on a ferrite toroid, you can get some very predictable, unusual performances, and you're slowly walking in that direction. I'll warn you, it's not easy, but without real proper grounding of those shields of coax cable, they will conduct signals between them, and signals are now coming out of that center conductor in a somewhat predictable manner. Not easy to predict, by the way, but could be modeled.
Question. What I try to understand is the interaction of the inner wire only dedicated to the first shield, and then the first shield interacts with the second, or the first shield, the inner wire, is not shielded by ungrounded first shield and interact with the second one at the same time?
Now, I think I see the nature of your question. You want to know, what is the coupling coefficient between the first center conductor and the first shield? And you want to know, is there a predictable amount of coupling coefficient between the first center conductor and the second shield?
Correct.
And the answer is yes, because things connected to the same thing are connected to each other. For the most part, the center conductor does not directly talk to the second outer shield. He talks to the first outer shield. 99% of what he does is to talk to the first outer shield. But the first outer shield does talk to the second outer shield. So the second outer shield is connected to the first, electronically speaking. The center conductor is connected to the first outer shield, electronically speaking. Things connected to the same thing are indirectly connected to each other. So when you study this, you'll find out the amount of radiation from center conductor to the second shield is very small directly, but reasonably large indirectly. Because the signal that you put on the first shield does couple to the second shield. That's the dominant signal that gets to the second shield. It's 99% of it, if you know what I mean. N2XJM, K2RIW.
N2XJM. So make the summary. If I have two wires, one next to the other, the space between them is exactly like the space in the coaxial cable, the inner wire and the shield. The difference between these two structures of the same length is different. In the coaxial cable, I have a 99% of talking center conductor into the first shield, or into the shield. Now, then the shield talks to the second shield. If I have two wires at the same length, at the same distance as the center conductor from the shield, but they are just parallel, like the balance cable used for the antennas, 300 ohms or 600 ohms, then if I put next wire into that, I will have the immediate interaction between that one of the wires that has 2-3 kilohertz on it, the second one that was lying next to it, and the one that I put from the right hand side. So the coupling, inductive coupling between this between the parallel or twin wire structure is a little bit different than between the coaxial one, right or wrong?
Yeah, here we got to be careful. If I construct a ribbon cable, which is three parallel wires on a flat plane, and if I now make the assumption that what happened in the coax cable happens here, the answer is no. In the case of a coaxial cable, the center conductor to the first shield has a certain amount of coupling coefficient. The center conductor to the second shield directly has almost no coupling coefficient. When I jump to three parallel wires, the most left-hand wire, I'm going to call it the center conductor, it has a certain coupling coefficient to the second wire, the middle wire. In the case of the middle wire, it is not a fully encased shield around the first wire. It's not a coaxial structure. Now you have a very different situation. Now the first wire, the left-hand wire, talks directly to the third wire. That's a moderately dominant signal. So when that shield doesn't go all the way around the circumference of the first wire, the amount of shielding is very different, much, much lower. Twisted pair does act as a very well shielded structure if and only if everything around it is very carefully controlled. If I put a third wire alongside of a twisted pair, depending on how I do it, I can get an awful lot of coupling to that third wire. In order to get around this problem, let me drop. If you study a piece of CAD 5 cable, that's the four twisted pair that's run through all of the drop ceilings of a lot of buildings in order for all the computers to talk to each other. There are eight wires in a CAD 5 cable. Four twisted pairs. You study those four twisted pairs, and you'll see that they've done something very sophisticated. There are four different twist rates. One of those two pairs of wire are twisted very tightly. The next one are twisted not as tight. The third twisted is not as tight. And the fourth are twisted less tight yet. Four different twist rates. In order to drastically lower the coupling coefficient between those four independent signals flowing down that cable. So twisted pair can give you some pretty good shielding if you obey the right rules, like making four different twist rates. Maybe that helps. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, beautiful help, N2XJN. Now let's go to question number five. Or, if you want to keep to the same subject, the fan of coaxial in question number seven would be exposed. It's up to you.
Okay, question number five is, does magnetic flux have temperature? And I think the answer is no. But with the materials you're likely to use, the answer is yes. Every magnetic material that you and I use has something called a Curie temperature, among other characteristics. My neodymium magnet, which has got a huge magnetic flux, if I buy it from the right company, all of that magnetic field will disappear forever if I heat it to a particular temperature. If I heat